Hello and welcome. I am Dr. Otis Johnson, and I'm your host for Beyond Compliance, an Otis Johnson podcast produced in collaboration with Applied Clinical Trials. This podcast is designed for pharmaceutical, clinical research, and healthcare leaders who are thinking seriously about what it takes to lead in a more accountable environment. We explore how compliance, sustainability, operational discipline, and business performance are becoming more interconnected across drug development, clinical trials, and the broader healthcare ecosystem. In today's episode, we are focusing on a persistent problem in drug development. Clinical trials are often designed around broad disease categories, average treatment effects, even when the patients within those categories differ substantially. When a therapy benefits a meaningful subgroup, that signal may be diluted across a highly varied study population. The result is that responders may be hidden, toxicity risk may be obscured, and a potentially valuable treatment may appear unsuccessful when judged only by the average patient. Artificial intelligence may help sponsors identify those patterns, but in regulated drug development, prediction alone is not enough. The evidence must be understandable, auditable, and defensible to clinicians, biostatisticians, and regulators. Our conversation today will examine how explainable AI can reveal clinically meaningful patient subgroups, help sponsors interpret placebo response more intelligently, and support better trial decisions before a program reaches its most expensive and consequential stage. I am pleased to welcome Dr. Joseph Geraci, co-founder and chief scientific and technical officer at Netramark. Joe brings a scientific and technical perspective on how sponsors can use explainable AI to produce clearer evidence about which patients are most likely to respond to therapy while preserving the transparency required in regulated research. Joe, welcome to Beyond Compliance.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great, great. It's good to have you. So before we examine the trial design implications, I want listeners to understand your vantage point and the scientific problem that led you to this work. So I know that you were a mathematician by training, but I want you to briefly tell us a little bit more about you and your role at Netramark and how your work led you to focus on explainable AI in clinical development.
Yeah, no, great. In brief, my obsession for decades has been complex systems. And so I actually have 3 degrees in mathematics. Mostly pure, but my doctorate ended up started in pure, but then an Israeli physicist named Daniel Lidar gave me a problem in quantum computation. I ended up working on that, getting sponsored by DARPA and, living in California for a bit, working on this problem. And that started me into this world where I started seeing hints of machine intelligence emerge. And then what happened was that turned into a lot of opportunities when I solved that problem in like physics and mathematics. But I decided to go into medicine. So I did a postdoc in oncology at Princess Margaret Hospital in Toronto. Then the Canadian government gave me an AI award for AI in medicine, and that came with money. So I was able to work with startups and stuff. It was great. And then some of my work was breaching from cancer into neuroscience because mathematics has a way of being able to generalize things. And so Eli Lilly sponsored me for my third postdoc in biological psychiatry and neuroscience. And I ended up becoming a professor and all this. But what really happened was, my students started asking, "Hey, Dr. G, can we use AI to model this patient population?" I'm like, "Well, there's 30 women in this ovarian cancer data set." But then I started playing around with machine learning. I started training neural networks and gradient boosting, all kinds of methods, right? And I really got a chance to learn like many of the machine learning paradigms. And then I was unsatisfied with the explainability, And with something else that I think we'll touch upon later, which is the most important part for understanding patient populations. And so I fumbled upon this mathematical paradigm that had this long-range memory. So I was able to start learning about the variables and find these magical combinations, which is really the most important aspect for this. So companies, Otis, they wanted me to help them with drug discovery. And, I helped them. I kind of created some of the techniques that they're using. But really, what I learned was that if you don't understand the patient populations, it doesn't matter, right? The clinical trial is really the nexus of this whole thing, right? And then, so just to finish up the story, I ended up quitting. I went to work for Equifax in their machine learning department, which was great. I got to work with huge data for a change. But at night, I would program and raise money. I raised a few million dollars and started Netramark. And its main focus the whole time has been around understanding the heterogeneity of these diseases through patient populations and learning from smaller data.
Wow, impressive background. Well, we're glad you came back to our industry, clinical research. So clinical trials often group patients under these broad disease labels and then evaluate whether the average patient benefited. And that approach can be statistically convenient. It's easy, you group everybody together. But it may not reflect the biological and clinical variation within the population. And I know that's what you're focusing on, but I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the potential consequences of taking that more broad average approach. What could go wrong, when we take that traditional approach?
Yeah, so it doesn't. The primary conflict is that biologically, it's true, we're very similar, obviously. Like we share a massive amount of genes, but you've noticed that we're all kind of different. We all have different faces and different morphologies, right? And this is true biochemically as well. It's really, really true. And so I think you're obscuring the real potential that the pharmaceutical space can take. This direction of precision medicine has a massive potential to reduce, the harmful consequences of medicine, and the fact there's a major economic problem with the way we're doing things, right? Because the failures are the rule. And the reason is because I would bet not all drugs, some drugs are just garbage, but most drugs are carefully created by really talented people. And I would bet that there are real benefits for real patients that are not getting those benefits, right? So there's basically economics left on the table. And I understand these companies want to get the biggest, market for their drug, and that's right. You want to do that, right? But you have to be honest about the heterogeneity that really exists, and that I've been able to see. I've been looking at patients through the lens of a data microscope, through AI, and through my own creations now for like 18 years, and I can tell you with all that experience, these diseases are not what we think.
Very important. So I guess one of the things that could be missed is some signal in particular subgroups, and we potentially missed the opportunity to pursue an aspect of a drug before maybe dropping it.
Yeah, that's right. There's real benefit that these drugs can have. And then, the other consequence is like, I think it's human nature to get really disappointed in a failure. And so there's a lot of drugs out there that probably have benefit, but they're just not tuned correctly to the market. And so I think there's this monstrous economic loss.
So Joe, you know that AI is pervasive in every industry now, and especially in our industry. And one of the challenges in our industry adopting AI is the idea of a black box, not being able to explain what you are observing. So AI can identify these complex patterns, but in our regulated drug development, it requires more than a model that produces a prediction. Sponsors need to understand how the conclusion was reached and whether the evidence can withstand scientific and regulatory scrutiny. So, why are black box AI models difficult to defend in our regulated drug development industry?
Yeah, I mean, well, you said it. Like, what has to happen is, look, this is a business about people, where we're making drugs for people, sometimes for animals, right? And we need people to scrutinize and to perform the science. AI is not going to be this, like, I'm going to drop my data in here and it's going to give me the answer. You need the biostatisticians. Right, you need the clinicians, and in order for that to happen, you need a layer of visibility into, what is driving the like. How do you characterize a set of patients that are going to be optimal for your drug? Or why is this drug actually working? Right, the mechanism of, we're already used to thinking that way, and we should be. Like, what is the mechanism of action, and what are other candidate variables that you might not necessarily be able to measure because of expense, and we just don't have the technology yet to get at that level. But are there like variables that build the bridge that accurately do characterize why a patient is responding? And this, what this does, it activates that whole chain from the data scientist to the statisticians to the clinicians. And then this builds confidence, and it allows us to do real science, not just some blinded prediction.
That's great. So I think you're getting into the concept of explainable AI, which is really what we need to be able to confidently say that what we're seeing in terms of a treatment effect and safety signals is actually accurate. So the value of explainable AI is not simply that a model can describe itself. The result must translate into evidence that the scientific and clinical decision makers can evaluate using variables that they recognize. So just tell me more about how explainable AI derived patient subgroup, what that looks like in practice, and why it's more useful for clinicians, biostatisticians, and regulators to really understand what's going on.
Yeah, sure. That'd be great. So I actually want to start on the opposite side here about, so what's happening in the AI industry, and it was predictable, right? Because there's a massive economic impetus for this, right? Which is to build models that can do a lot of things at the same time. This is what allows companies like Anthropic to offer the service that they do, right? The problem with these models is that they're trained on huge amounts of data with a technology that averages, that works on averages. And so the next word that it predicts is based on this really, really great averaging, and it's great technology. It's able to do it. However, patient populations, the average is you're actually obscuring the important aspects of your clinical trial with that averaging. And so what happens is this averaging that these models do versus the cost of figuring out the subpopulations is real. And I've done thousands of simulations on this, right? And now I can get to your question, right? So just keep that in mind. Where the world has gone with AI has real consequences in here, because it's designed for one thing, but clinical trial data are not traffic signs or pictures of cats and dogs or learning how to speak Italian fluently. It's different. It's a different beast technically. And so now we hit upon this idea of the model-derived subgroup, which is what we do at Naturemark, right? With this alternative machine intelligence, it's not based on these same models, Otis. It's an alternative system. And what happens there is you essentially, this system, without paying the same price that these large models would have to pay in terms of effect size, we don't have to get into that, but there's a real consequence, right? Is without paying that price, what you're able to do is this system is able to admit when it doesn't understand certain patients, and it's able to understand with high effect size some substructures of the data. And this is magic, because what happens here is the machine can then tell you, hey, you know what? The patients that really respond here have this genetic variant or have this imaging property or have this height. Like for example, it could be blood pressure in this range plus a certain BMI. Okay. This model-derived subgroup, this characterization allows you to then go reach into the field and say, okay, patients who are characterized in this way actually will have the advantage, will actually respond to the drug and not respond to placebo, for example, right? Are you like Otis? I think I'm communicating that basically what this provides is a way to characterize patients in terms of response and placebo response.
Yeah, no, indeed. So I want to follow up on something you said about detecting these early signals about which subgroups are responding in which way. So when you think about how we could apply that in practice, my mind immediately goes to an adaptive design trials where in a blinded way you can identify these early signals and maybe you can make some suggestions about which types of patients to enroll in subsequent parts of the trial to get a better understanding of that early signal. Is that a potential application here?
Definitely. And it's always been adaptive trials keep bumping into me, right? And it's you're right. And because it's a natural question, where we're monitoring the popularity of adaptive trials carefully, because you're right, Otis, like our potential for that aspect of clinical trials is very strong. However, the way sponsors are moving right now, like where they are right now, adaptive trials may be taken up later. But where our focus right now is, you spent all this money on an earlier phase, and our thesis is that there's very valuable information in it. It's just hard to excavate. Okay. What this allows us to do as a company is we can go to the sponsor, learn from the previous trial, and figure out what part of that data is actually transportable to the next one. So this is not about predictions. I mean, of course, there's predictions in it, don't get me wrong. But it's more important than that. What it is there something that you can learn that you can impose on your next trial, so that you can control it for, and move towards a win, right? And that's the magic here. It's transporting insights from through time.
Yes. No, that's I understand that. That's a good approach. So I'm thinking about a large phase three trials. That's really expensive. How do we get this type of insight, this explainable AI, earlier on in the process to really help sponsors maximize the benefit of this new type of insight?
Yeah, well, this is exactly, you're hitting upon why my approach that, it's very tricky, right? But the approach is, how do we use the limited data that you collect early? Exactly, because phase three is a bonanza compared to phase two. So you have to find a way to learn insights from phase two that you can then push into phase three. Which means ultimately you need a paradigm of learning that is specialized for this scenario. It's just the truth, right? Models, right? The methods that we're using now require huge amounts of data. So what you're asking for is very difficult, and that's why we use this other approach. And the secret to this other approach is literally knowing when to say it doesn't know.
Yes. No, that's it's hard to admit that you don't know anything. You think that AI knows
And our AI Our large language models, they can't admit when they don't know. They just keep going and going, right? So it's an important humanistic quality, right? Which is, as we mature, we learn to admit when we don't know something, right?
Yes,
It's a
yes.
power.
So Joe, I want to close by returning to the premise of this podcast, which is moving beyond compliance does not mean lowering the evidentiary standard. It means using better methods to create evidence that is more informative, transparent, and defensible. So what does it mean to move beyond compliance when using AI to generate evidence for drug development?
Yeah, so I think that there's going to be a philosophical change, right? And it's and actually we're benefiting from the AI boom, right? Because I think it's opened our expectations and the potential of these technologies. It just has to be done correctly because a lot of people we're noticing are signing up for and hiring AI experts to run these large models to or even train large models. And you end up obscuring the whole point of precision medicine by doing this. And so what it means to me is focusing my research program and you know our program at NetraMark to helping to solve exactly this problem. Can you reveal the taxonomy, right? Because otherwise, this is what's happening, Otis. If I give you one dart and I ask you to hit five dartboards with the one dart, you're gonna think I'm crazy, right? You'll throw it, you'll hit one of the darts. And this is what clinical trials looks like to me right now. You need to know where you're aiming. And you should try to get as many people as possible at once, of course, right? But you have to be honest about those substructures because there's real value there. It's very important to go for as broad a label as possible for the sponsor. This is very important economically, but you don't want to force it beyond what is true for that patient population, right? And so I believe there has to be a balance between the reality of biology and the economic realities of being, having running a successful trial.
Excellent. Great. So, Joe, thank you. This has been a thoughtful and important conversation. What stands out to me is that the average treatment effect can conceal as much as it reveals. When broad disease categories combine patients from different biology, different risk, and different likelihoods of response, sponsors may miss a meaningful signal or advance a program without fully understanding who benefits and who may be harmed. Explainable AI offers a path to more precise evidence, but its value depends on transparency. And as you pointed out, knowing when to say, I don't have the answer. The strongest models are not simply predictive, they produce clinically recognizable findings that decision makers can examine, challenge, audit, and defend before a trial re reaches regulators. So, thank you to our listeners for joining us for this episode of Beyond Compliance, an Otis Johnson podcast produced in collaboration with Applied Clinical Trials. I am Otis Johnson. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to the next conversation.